This is the Mother Jones Podcast. I'm Jamila King in Brooklyn. On today's show, you follow Mother Jones. You know that we've been reporting on right-wing extremism for a long time. The insurrection at the Capitol was a shock, yes, a terrible, deadly catastrophe. Not exactly a surprise or a one-time thing. Right-wing violence is an integral part of the American story. The Ku Klux Klan, the Oklahoma City bombing, Charlottesville, the El Paso Walmart shooting, Kenosha, to name a tiny few. On today's show, how Trump is harnessing domestic terrorism and white supremacy to stay in office and break democracy. Stick around. We're here with Mark Fulman, Mother Jones's national affairs editor. He's been tracking Trump's fomenting of right-wing extremism for years. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
We seem to only talk to you when really bad stuff happens.
Yes. Unfortunate, but true.
The last time we spoke, we talked about how Trump was giving extremist right-wing ideologies a pass after the Christchurch shooting.
You know, it was really interesting to watch Trump's response. You know, so many of us have grown used to that by now, but that sends a very strong signal to people who are subscribing to these hateful ideologies that they have his tacit support or acknowledgement, or at least he's not going to really go after them. Those people have his back, and he apparently has theirs. He's with them. You know, you see in the language of the attacker in New Zealand, this manifesting, right? He talks about how Trump was a symbol of renewed white identity and common purpose. So you can see really directly the effect of Trump's positioning on this stuff over time. He's very consistent in this way, emboldening the fringes to come kind of into the mainstream with their ideas, to feel like they have license now, that when you have someone like Trump in power speaking and acting in the ways that he is, it has a real world effect.
It strikes me, even then, we saw something like this coming.
Well, you know, I think a lot of people are now looking at the way that President Trump has fomented extremism in a whole different light after the siege of the Capitol. Just a remarkable and devastating turn of events. It's I guess, easier to see in hindsight, but really that event and those acts of violence are something that's been building throughout his presidency and something we've been tracking for almost 5 years now.
The morning of the attacks on the Capitol, before the insurrection happened, you literally wrote that Trump is inciting violence around election results. Did you think you'd be this correct?
Well, in the last several weeks, I had written about the kind of escalation of Trump's incitement. I think we can look at his presidency as a whole and see this pattern of behavior, of incitement, but then also what happened after the November election, where really it escalated to a whole next level.
If you count the legal votes, I easily win. If you count the illegal votes, they can try to steal the election from us. If you count the votes that came in late.
His campaign of lies around the election being stolen.
As everybody saw, we won by historic numbers.
And then specifically inciting his base of supporters to take action.
All of us here today do not want to see our election victory stolen by emboldened radical left Democrats, which is what they're doing.
I wouldn't have necessarily known to predict what would happen on January 6th in the nation's capital, but I think anyone who was paying attention to the rhetoric that Trump was using and the kind of campaign of incitement he was pursuing was able to see that bad things were coming and that it would lead to violence.
Our country has had enough. We will not take it anymore. And that's what this is all about.
And that's something that I had reported on and written about literally for years, in his targeting of different interest groups, his racist messaging, his targeting of journalists. And then eventually we see him targeting American political leaders, namely Democrats, who were against him in the election and in the aftermath of the election.
Tell us about that reporting. How did you know that this was coming?
Well, for a long time, there was evidence building during Trump's presidency of his most extreme supporters taking up his rhetoric and his ideas and turning them into threatening behavior and in many cases violence. There was reporting of incidents around the country of people who were perpetrating violent threats or acts of violence that were parroting his rhetoric. One prominent example you'll recall was from last year when there was a mass shooting in Texas. The perpetrator of that attack cited the invasion of Texas by immigrants, which was a message that Trump and his supporters had hammered for a long time, that there were so-called caravans of migrants coming to invade the United States through the southern border.
The Democrat Party is openly inviting millions of illegal aliens to break our laws, violate our borders, and overwhelm our nation. Democrats produce mobs. Republicans produce jobs.
Just one example of a violent attack that was seemingly based in directly in Trump's rhetoric. And there were many others that were directed at journalists. I did a big investigative report on that in 2018, how his targeting of the media as the enemy of the people was leading to violent threats and in some cases beatings or attacks on journalists. And so I think it was rather obvious and logical that once he turned the full fury of his extremist rhetoric on the 2020 election, that would lead to violence in the wake of the election. And that's exactly what we saw with the assault on Congress.
Mark, former national security officials and defense secretaries sounded the alarm to you. What did they say?
I think as Trump was continuing to escalate his messaging around the so-called stolen election and his whole theory of fraud.
All of us here today do not want to see our election victory stolen by emboldened radical left Democrats, which is what they're doing, and stolen by the fake news media. That's what they've done and what they're doing.
None of which was true, but which was speaking to really a grievance, a level of deep grievance in his supporters that experts started to see that this could turn dangerous. And I think one of the problems was that the media and the political class in general had never really taken it that seriously or had talked about it in terms of divisiveness or Trump's unconventional style or that he was voted into office to shake up the system and those kinds of ways of framing the issue. But really what he was doing was a method of incitement. And I started hearing about a concept known as stochastic terrorism, which is really a way of looking at this method of incitement as deliberate. And that's what I was starting to hear about from national security experts.
You just use this word stochastic terrorism to describe Trump's tactics. What is that exactly?
Stochastic terrorism is a concept known to national security experts, specifically in the realm of counterterrorism. It was historically understood in the context of international terrorist organizations like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and prior to that, to some degree, with anti-abortion religious extremists, far-right extremists. And essentially what it refers to is a method where an instigator provokes extremist violence randomly, but does so beneath the guise of plausible deniability. So it's done in veiled language or messaging primarily. And so in other words, what stochastic terrorism means is the instigation of random but essentially predictable violence, which means you don't know exactly who's going to do it or where or when it's going to happen, but you know it's going to happen. And what Trump did in this regard was really unprecedented, is he brought stochastic terrorism as a method into American politics in a way we've never seen before, into the presidency, by continually pushing these messages based on lies and incitement, whipping up anger and division among supporters with ideas that, you know, their lives were being stolen away from them, the election was being stolen, and that they had to fight back, to fight about it. And this involves using incendiary language, a lot of which Trump did on Twitter. So part of my reporting in recent weeks looked at tweets he was using after the presidential election. And just to give an example of how he would create plausible deniability for himself, there was one tweet I wrote about where he was talking about this supposedly stolen election as an act of war and a fight to the death, but he had framed it in the terms, in hypothetical terms. He essentially said if this were reversed and this were Democrats who held the presidency and it was Democratic senators, that they would see this as an act of war and a fight to the death. So he's able to use that kind of violent language to try to compel action, but to do so in a way that could be later dismissed. And we saw this a lot through his presidency as well, when he or people around him would say, oh, he was only joking when he said that, or he condemns hate groups after he says things like, you know, the Proud Boys, the neo-fascist hate group that he was confronted about during the presidential debate in the fall, you know, when Trump infamously said they should stand back and stand by.
What do you want to call them? Give me a name. Give me a
white
name.
Supremacists and
would
right
you like me to condemn?
White Proud Boys.
Proud Boys.
And right
Proud Boys. Stand back and stand by.
What did he mean by that? His supporters, a certain segment of his most extreme supporters, know exactly what he meant by that. And that's the whole point of stochastic terrorism.
Like you're saying, so much of what Trump says is just word salad, and he hides behind that. People have long been calling out Trump's clearly racist dog whistles, but an expert you spoke with said, quote, the term dog whistle is too benign here. Has Trump now forfeited any shred of plausible deniability?
That's a good question. I think, you know, certainly there's a large segment of the American population who won't see it that way. Still, including his most sycophantic supporters in Congress and the Republican Party. But I think if you look at the facts of what has happened, that's certainly true, that there's no longer any deniability that's believable for Trump in terms of what he's done to incite extremism and violent activity, which so far has culminated in the siege on the U.S. Capitol last week. And there's no question that it's rooted in lies and in racist ideas and in the promotion of white supremacy. That's been a centerpiece of his politics, going all the way back to his presidential campaign in 2016, which we reported on at length at the time. The groups that were gravitating to him from the far right, extremists who were embracing his rhetoric and announcing their support for him, to which he responded with nothing other than a wink or tacit support or sort of vague denials when pressed on it. And that has had the effect of emboldening and mobilizing now this far right extremist movement and white supremacist movement.
Coming up after the break, Trump kicked off Twitter. Will it make a difference? Stick around. And hey, we are here. We have not been kicked off of any platforms, and we could really use your support. It's so easy to do. Just go to wherever you listen to this podcast and hit that subscribe button. Thanks.
The Mother Jones stories you're hearing right now are brought to you by our listeners and loyal readers who fuel our work. Audience support makes up 2/3 of the Mother Jones budget and helps our team dig deep on stories that matter. Make a donation at motherjones.com/give to keep our nonprofit newsroom humming. Again, that's motherjones.com/give.
Welcome back to the show. We're here with Mark Fulman, Mother Jones's national affairs editor, going over the government's failure to stop violence at the Capitol last week. Mark, director of the FBI, Christopher Wray, said last year that the domestic threat was real. In fact, it was the major terrorism threat.
And I will say that a majority of the domestic terrorism cases that we've investigated are motivated by some version of what you might call white supremacist violence, but it includes other things as well.
What has he done or not done to combat that threat?
You know, I think the answer to that is that we don't really know, or at least not in full. There's been very little communication out of the Department of Justice and the FBI in recent months, and particularly since the election and the siege of the Capitol last week. We have seen some action by the Department of Justice to disrupt terrorist activity of this nature, foremost with the plot to seize the Michigan state capitol over the summer and potentially kidnap and assassinate the Michigan governor, Gretchen Whitmer. So we know that in that sense, the FBI has pursued some of this activity. But beyond Christopher Wray, the FBI director, saying last year that this was a top domestic terrorist threat, which I believe was then followed up later by the Department of Homeland Security, we don't really know much about what the federal government has been doing to counter that threat.
Reports are mounting that the threat to Congress last week was not taken seriously. Why wasn't anyone listening?
It's a really good question, and it's a subject of my further reporting right now. There are real concerns that I'm hearing from a number of current and former national security officials about the failure of leadership here. And we've seen anecdotal reporting of sympathetic elements in law enforcement agencies and in the military. We know that there were ex-military and law enforcement people involved in the insurrection at the Capitol. So this is a very troubling picture. We don't really know the extent of those kinds of sympathies or perhaps complicity that's going on in the national security apparatus, but we know that it's there. This was also the subject of some reports last year, including from former FBI agent Michael German, who is at the Brennan Center, looking at the infiltration of white supremacist movements into the nation's law enforcement agencies. So this is a real problem. The question of what is our law enforcement and national security system doing to deal with this threat that in some ways is very insidious and within our society now in ways that I don't think we've reckoned with yet.
What do you think we should see from the incoming Biden administration?
Well, there are a number of things I think that the Biden administration can do, starting at the top. I mean, President Biden, his messaging, if you recall, when he launched his presidential campaign was a fight for the soul of the nation, right?
May history be able to say that the end of this chapter of American darkness began here tonight as love and hope and light join in the battle for the soul of the nation.
And those kinds of communications and that messaging, I think, is very important. Part of the reason that this has gotten so dangerous and out of control is you have the president of the United States, the current one, Donald Trump, leading the charge, leading it in messaging, leading it in some ways operationally, talking about where people should go and what they should do. Come to Washington and it'll be wild on January 6th.
President Trump tweeted that a Stop the Steal protest will take place in Washington, D.C. next week. That's Wednesday, and the same day Congress meets to formally count the votes cast by the Electoral College.
Messaging like that is extremely dangerous, and that will go away, and we will have a president who's saying the opposite, that America needs to unite, that we need to work together again. And also to, as one expert has put it to me, to shame that kind of activity that we've seen by Trump and his supporters, to shame these ideas of division and hate. That's very important, that the kind of most prominent political messaging in America shifts. And then also, there's a lot that the Biden administration can do tactically in terms of law enforcement, you know, running the Justice Department and FBI and Department of Homeland Security with people who are focused on this threat, focused on disrupting it, and taking a much more active role in tamping down and relegating again to the fringe of American society these dangerous elements, because they've always been there. As we know, this is not new. This violent white supremacist movement is ingrained in our history and always has been. But we've just been living through a time where it has been mainstreamed like no other time in the modern era. And I think that the government leadership to tamp that down starts at the top and goes on down from there. So I think we'll see the Biden administration take this very seriously and work hard to prioritize the danger. That said, you know, Biden is coming in at an extremely difficult time in the country with the pandemic, the threat to the economy, and so on. So this is a daunting task that is added to his plate now.
Trump has now been banned from the major social media sites, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, Snapchat, Reddit, Twitch, Parler, an online forum where right-wingers were flocking, got kicked off Amazon's web hosting services. Does deplatforming work?
I think it does. I think it can and it does. Certainly in this situation, to take away those channels from someone who's effectively become the leader of a terrorist movement. I know that sounds crazy to say in a certain sense that the president of the United States is that, but part of what I learned through my reporting on this problem is that we need to call it what it is. And I think a lot of national security experts are starting to see that or have come to see it that way. And so if you accept the notion that that is the way that Trump is acting and that's the role he's playing, then you also have to look at the fact that he's had throughout his presidency unfettered access to some of the most powerful communication platforms in history, namely social media, Twitter and Facebook primarily. And he's used those channels very effectively to spread his campaign of lies about the election and to stir up hatred and extremism. And we're really tasting the bitter fruits of that now as it's continued to escalate. So to take that away, I think, is very important. And I will say that, you know, I think to some degree, the debate over censorship in the media and social media is a total red herring. There is a very valid debate that needs to be had about liability of the big tech companies and social media platforms and potential monopoly issues there. But at the end of the day, Trump's reach to millions and millions and millions of people with his poisonous messaging is very dangerous. And taking that away, I think has quite a powerful effect. I mean, look, it's not just what he says in tweets. It's also things that he promotes. And I think this has probably been under the radar more. I reported in one of my stories on stochastic terrorism that in about the 3 weeks or so running up to the January 6th assault on the Capitol, Trump wasn't just saying, you know, come to Washington and fight like hell. He was also promoting videos that were kind of slickly produced propaganda portraying America as part of a, you know, kind of religious war and alleging all kinds of crazy conspiracy theories like involving the Chinese communist government. There was one called The Plot to Steal America that he tweeted at least three times to his 80 plus million followers.
Stay with me and you'll see just what's going on behind the scenes in this election and why the greatest threat we're facing right now is not an invisible enemy invading our bodies, but one that's invading our country and our minds.
So I think, you know, that kind of material national security experts see as very dangerous, and he's spreading it in a way that is massive and exponential. So reducing that spread, I think, is important and a powerful tactic to countering what he's doing.
Finally, a new FBI bulletin says that armed protests are being planned in all 50 states from now through inauguration. How scared should listeners be that we've only seen a preview?
That's a tough question to answer right now, honestly. I think this is such an unprecedented situation. And the questions I alluded to earlier about how much can we really rely on law enforcement leadership and the government right now, It's a frightening time. But that said, I think there are a lot of good people who work in law enforcement and in the government who are now very focused on this after January 6th, as they should be. I mean, this is an existential threat to the country, potentially, and to our system of democracy. And so the level of concern and vigilance is very heightened. And there's a lot to be worried about. But hopefully we will get through these next couple of weeks, bring in the new president. I think there is the expectation that there will be more violent activity, but the government response now is looking quite different than it was in preparation for January 6th. So hopefully things will go okay and not be too rough in the weeks ahead.
Mark, thanks so much for joining the show. This is such a chaotic and terrifying time, so it really helps to have you on to sort of explain some of it.
Always good to talk with you, Jamila. Thanks.
That's it this week for the Mother Jones podcast. Again, if you want to support the show, it's really easy. Just hit the subscribe button. And also, be sure to check out our previous episode featuring the first-person story of Matt Cohen, a reporter on the scene of the insurrection.
I'm Andrea Guzman, and I'm a fellow in the San Francisco office. Right now, I'm working on a story about President Trump's visit to South Texas and the activists who have opposed it. Here are the credits for today's show. Theme music for the Mother Jones podcast was composed by Micah Barrick at Hear Film. This week's show was produced by Molly Schwartz, our associate producer, and James West, our executive producer. James West did the mixing and mastering, with additional production by Mark Helenowski and Jamila King. And credit where credit is due. Mother Jones is supported by you, our listeners and readers. So thanks.
I'm your host, Jamila King in Brooklyn. Thanks for tuning in as always, and we'll see you next week. This podcast is brought to you by Mother Jones listeners like you who donate to keep our newsroom buzzing. Help us stay on the beat. Go to motherjones.com/give.